The moon, the moon, the moon, the moon.
Laguna Beach, California.
The moon! The moon!
Dominic Corvaces was awakened by his own fearful shouting and by a burning pain in his right wrist. He was on his hands and knees in the darkness beside his bed, wrenching frantically at something that had a grip on his arm. He continued to struggle for a few seconds until the mists of sleep cleared, whereupon he realized that he was being held by nothing more sinister than the rope with which he had tethered himself. Breathing raggedly, heart pounding, he fumbled for the lamp switch and winced as the sudden light stung his eyes. A quick look at the restraining rope showed that in his sleep, and in the dark, he had completely untied one of the four tightly drawn knots and partially unraveled a second before losing patience for the task. Then, in the panic that always accompanied his sleepwalking, he evidently had begun to pull and tug and twist against the belaying line as if he were a dumb animal protesting a leash, painfully abrading his right wrist. Dom got off the floor and, pushing aside the tangled blankets, sat on the edge of the bed. He knew he had been dreaming, though he could not recall anything about the dream. However, he was pretty sure that it was not the nightmare he had endured on other occasions during the past month, for that one had had nothing to do with the moon. This was another dream, equally terrifying, but in a different way. His shouts, which had been partly responsible for waking him, had been so importunate, so haunted, so fright-filled that he could even now summon them in memory as clearly as he had first heard them. "The moon! The moon!" he shuddered and raised his hands to his throbbing head. "The moon! What did it mean?" Boston, Massachusetts. Ginger sat straight up in bed with a shrill cry. Lavinia, the Hannaby's housekeeper, said,
"Ah, I'm sorry, Dr. Wise. Didn't mean to scare you. You are having a nightmare."
"Nightmare?" Ginger had no recollection of a dream.
"Oh, yes," Lavinia said, "and a really bad one from the sound of it. I was passing in the hall when I heard you crying out. I almost came in right away, until I realized you must be dreaming. I hesitated then, but you went on and on, shouting it over and over again, until I thought I'd better wake you."
Blinking, Ginger said,
"Shouting? What was I shouting?" "Over and over again," the housekeeper said. "The moon! The moon! The moon! You sounded so frightened."
"I don't remember."
"The moon," Lavinia assured her. "The moon! Over and over again, in such a voice that I half thought someone was killing you."
Part 2. Days of Discovery. Courage is resistance to fear, mastery of fear, not absence of fear. Mark Twain. Is there some meaning to this life? What purpose lies behind the strife? Whence do we come? Where are we bound? These cold questions echo and resound through each day, each lonely night. We long to find the splendid light that will cast a revelatory beam upon the meaning of the human dream. The Book of Counted Sorrows. A friend may well be reckoned the masterpiece of nature. Ralph Waldo Emerson. Chapter 4, December 26th through January 11th. 1. Boston, Massachusetts. Between December 27th and January 5th, Dr. Ginger Weiss went to Pablo Jackson's Back Bay apartment 6 times. On 6 of those visits, he used hypnotic therapy to probe cautiously and patiently at the Azrael block that sealed off a portion of her memory. To the old magician, she grew more beautiful each time she arrived at his door, more intelligent, charming, and appealingly tough-minded, too. Pablo saw in her the kind of woman he would have wanted as a daughter. Ginger had stirred in him protective, fatherly feelings that he had never known before. He told her nearly everything he had learned from Alexander Kristoffson at the Hergensheimer's Christmas party. She resisted the idea that her memory block had not developed naturally, but had been implanted by persons unknown.
"Too bizarre. Things like that don't happen to ordinary people like me. I'm just a farmishta from Brooklyn, not someone who gets involved in international intrigue."
The only thing about his conversation with Alex Kristoffson that he did not tell her was that the retired espionage officer had warned against becoming involved with her. If Ginger knew Alex had been deeply disturbed, she might decide that the situation was too dangerous to justify Pablo's involvement. Out of concern for her, and out of a selfish desire to be a part of her life, he withheld that information. At their first meeting on December 27th, prior to the session of hypnosis, he prepared a lunch of quiche and salad. As they ate, Ginger said,
"But I've never been around a sensitive military installation, never been involved in any defense research, never associated with anyone who could conceivably be part of a spy ring. It's ludicrous."
"If you stumbled on some dangerous bit of knowledge, it wasn't in a high-security area. It was someplace you had every right to be, except you just happened to be there at the wrong time."
"But listen, Pablo, if they brainwashed me, that would have taken time. They'd have had to hold me in custody somewhere, right?"
"I imagine it would take a few days."
"So you can't be right," she said. "Of course, I realized that while they were forcing me to forget the thing I had accidentally seen, they'd also repress the memory of the place where they held me for the brainwashing. But there'd be a blank spot in my past somewhere, an empty time when I couldn't remember where I'd been or what I'd done."
"Not at all. They'd implant a set of false recollections to cover the missing days, and you'd never know the difference."
"Good God! Really? They could do that?"
"One thing I hope to do is locate those false memories," Pablo explained as he finished his quiche. "It'll take a long time, slowly regressing you back through your life, week by week. But when I find the phony memories, I'll recognize them to the sweet, because they won't have the detail, the substance of genuine memories. Mere stage sets, you see. If we find 2 or 3 days of tissue-thin memories, will have pinpointed the origin of your problem, because those will be the dates when you were in the hands of these people, whoever they may be."
"Yes. Yes, I see," she said, suddenly excited. "The first day of the mushy memories will be the day that I saw something I shouldn't have seen, and the last day will be the day they finished brainwashing me. It's terribly difficult to believe, but if someone really did implant this memory block, and if all my symptoms, the fugues, are a result of those repressed memories struggling to the surface, then my problem isn't really psychological. There's a chance I could practice medicine again. All I've got to do is dig out the memories, bring them into the light, and then the pressure will be relieved."
Pablo took her hand and gave it a squeeze.
"Yes, I believe there's real hope. But it's not going to be easy. Every time I probe at the block, I risk plunging you into a coma. Or worse. I intend to be, oh, so careful. But the risk remains."
The first 2 sessions of deep hypnosis were conducted in armchairs by the huge bay window, one on December 27th, one on Sunday the 29th, each lasting 4 hours. Pablo regressed her day by day through the previous 9 months, but found no obviously artificial memories. Also on Sunday, Ginger suggested he question her about Dominic Corvaces, the novelist whose picture affected her in such a peculiar manner. When Pablo hypnotized her and established that he was speaking to the inner Ginger, to her deep, subconscious self, he asked if she had ever met Corvaces, and after a brief hesitation she said yes. Pablo pursued the point cautiously and diligently, but he could get almost nothing more out of her. At last, a thin vapor of memory escaped her.
"He threw salt in my face."
"Corvaces, threw salt on you? Puzzled, Pablo asked, Why?
Can't quite remember.
Where did this happen? Her frown deepened, and when he continued to pursue the subject, she withdrew, sinking into that frightening, comatose state. He quickly retreated before she had spiraled down as deep as she had done before. He assured her that he would ask no further questions about Corvaces if only she would return, and gradually she responded to that promise. Clearly, Ginger had at one time met Corvaces, and her encounter with him was associated with the memories of which she had been robbed. In the next two sessions, Monday the 30th and Wednesday, first day of the new year, Pablo regressed Ginger yet another 8 months to the end of July 2 summers ago, without discovering any tissue-thin memories that would indicate the work of mind-control specialists. Then, on Thursday, January 2nd, Ginger asked him to question her about her previous night's unremembered dream. For the fourth time since Christmas, she had cried out in her sleep, the moon, with such insistence that she woke others in Baywatch.
I think the dream's about the place and time that's been stolen from me. Put me in a trance and maybe we'll learn something.
But when hypnotized and returned to last night's dream, she refused to answer questions and drifted into a deeper sleep than a mere hypnotic trance. He had pulled the Azrael trigger once more, which was positive proof that her dreams involved those forbidden memories. On Friday they did not meet. Pablo needed the day to read further about memory blocks of all kinds and to think about how best to proceed. In addition, he had recorded all 5 post-Christmas sessions, so he sat at the reproduction Sheraton desk in his book-lined study and listened to portions of those tapes for hours. He was searching for a single word or a change in Ginger's voice that might make a particular answer seem more important on rehearing than it had seemed at the time. He found nothing startling, though he noticed that, during hypnotic regression, a subtle note of anxiety had entered her voice when their backward journey through time had reached August 31st of the year before last. It was nothing dramatic that would have caught his attention at the time the recordings were made, but by telescoping all the sessions into one afternoon, using the fast-forward control to skip from day to day, he saw the pattern of steadily building anxiety, and he suspected they were getting close to the event now hidden behind the Azrael block. Therefore, during their 6th post-Christmas session on Saturday, January 4th, Pablo was not surprised when the breakthrough came. As usual, Ginger was sitting in one of the armchairs by the bay window, beyond which a fine snow was falling. Her silver blonde hair glowed with spectral light. As he regressed her back through July of the previous year, her brows knitted, and her voice became whispery and tense, and Pablo knew she was drawing closer to the moment of her forgotten ordeal. Since they were going backward in time, he had already taken her through her busy months as a surgical resident at Memorial Hospital, back to the moment when she first reported to George Hannaby for duty on Monday, July 30th, more than 17 months ago. Her memories remained sharp and richly detailed as Pablo conveyed her into Sunday, July 29th, when she still had been settling into her new apartment. July 28th, 27th, 26th, 25th, 24th, through those days she had been unpacking and shopping for furniture, all the way back to July 21st, 20th, 19th. On July 18th, the moving van arrived with her household goods, which she had shipped from Palo Alto, California, where she had lived the previous 2 years while taking an advanced course of study in vascular surgery. Farther back. On July 17th, she arrived in Boston by car and booked a room overnight at the Holiday Inn Government Center, as close to Beacon Hill as possible, not yet able to stay at her new apartment because she had no bed there. By car? You drove cross-country from Sanford.
It was the first vacation I ever really had. I liked to drive, and it was a chance to see a little of the country.
Ginger said, but in such an ominous voice that she might have been talking about a journey through hell rather than a transcontinental holiday. So Pablo began to regress her through the days of her journey, back across the Midwestern heartland, around the northernmost horn of the Rocky Mountains, through Utah, into Nevada, until they came to Tuesday morning, July 10th. She had stayed the previous night at a motel, and when he asked for the name of it, a shudder passed through her.
Tranquility.
Tranquility Motel. Where is this place? Describe it, too. On the arms of her chair, her hands curled into fists.
30 miles west of Elko, on Interstate 80.
Haltingly, reluctantly, she described the 20-unit Tranquility Motel and Grill. Something about the place terrified her. Every muscle in her body went rigid. Pablo said,
"So you stayed the night of July 9th at the motel. That was a Monday."
"All right.
So now it's Monday, July 9th. You're just arriving at the motel. You haven't stayed there yet. You're just driving up to it. What time of the day is it?"
She did not answer, and her tremors grew more pronounced. And when he asked again, she said,
"I didn't arrive on Monday. Friday."
Startled, Pablo said,
"The previous Friday? You stayed at the Tranquility Motel from Friday, July 6th, to Monday, July 9th? 4 nights at this small motel in the middle of nowhere?"
He leaned forward in his chair, sensing that they had found the time when her mind had been tampered with. "Why would you want to stay so long?" In a slightly wooden voice, she said,
"Because it was peaceful. I was on vacation, after all."
Her strangely stilted voice became more flat and devoid of nuance with each word she spoke.
"I needed to relax, you see, and this was a perfect place to relax."
The old magician looked away from her, watched the faintly luminous snow slanting down through the dreary gray afternoon beyond the window, and carefully considered his next question.
"You said this motel has no swimming pool, and the rooms you've described aren't luxurious, not resort-style rooms for long-term visits. What on earth did you do for 4 days out there in the middle of nowhere, Ginger?"
"Like I said, I relaxed. Just relaxed. Napped. Read a couple of books. Watched some TV. They have good TV even way out there in the plains because they've got their own little satellite receiver dish on the roof."
Her manner of speech was now entirely altered, and she sounded as if she were reading from a script.
"After 2 intense years at Stanford, I needed a few days of doing absolutely nothing."
"What books did you read while at the motel?"
I don't remember."
Her hands were still fisted, and she was still rigid. Fine, pearly beads of sweat popped out along her hairline.
"Ginger, you're there now, in the motel room, reading. Understand? You are reading whatever you were reading then. Now, look at the title of the book and tell me what it is."
No title."
"Every book has a title."
"No title."
"Because there really is no book, is there?"
"Yes. I just relaxed, napped, read a couple of books, watched some TV,"
she said in a soft, dead, emotionless voice.
They have good TV even way out there on the plains because they've got their own little satellite receiver dish on the roof.
What TV shows did you watch?
News. Movies.
What movies? She flinched.
I don't remember.
Pablo was quite sure that the reason she did not remember these things was precisely because she had never done them. She had been at that motel all right, because she could describe it in minute detail, but she could not recall the books and the TV programs because she had never passed any of that time in those pursuits. Through clever post-hypnotic suggestions, she had been instructed to say that she had done those things, and she had actually been made to remember vaguely having done them. But they were merely artificial memories designed to cover what had really transpired at that motel. A specialist in brainwashing could insert false memories in a subject's mind, but even if he worked very hard at it and built an intricate web of interlocking details, he could not make the phony memories as convincing as real ones. Pablo said, "Where did you eat dinner each night?"
"The Tranquility Grill. It's a small place, and it doesn't have much of a menu, but the food is reasonably good."
That response was once again delivered in a flat and hollow voice. Pablo said, "What did you eat at the Tranquility Grill?" She hesitated.
I don't remember.
"But you told me the food was good. How could you make that judgment if you don't remember what you ate?"
It's a small place, and it doesn't have much of a menu."
The more insistently he pressed for details, the more tense she became. Her voice remained emotionless as she spewed out her programmed responses, but her face twisted and hardened with anxiety. Pablo could have told her that her apparent memories of those 4 days at the Tranquility Motel were false. He could have ordered her to blow them out of her mind, the way one might blow dust from an old book, and she would have done it. Then he could have told her that her true memories were locked behind an Azrael block, and that she must hammer it into more dust. But if he had done so, she would have plunged, as programmed, into a coma. Or worse. He would have to spend many days, possibly weeks, looking for tiny cracks to exploit cautiously. For today, he contented himself with identifying the precise number of hours of her life that had been stolen from her. He took her back to Friday, July 6th, of the summer before last, and asked exactly when she signed the register at the Tranquility Motel.
"A little after 8 o'clock.
She no longer spoke in a wooden voice because these were real memories.
"It was still an hour before sunset, but I was exhausted. All I wanted was dinner, a shower, and bed."
She described the man and woman behind the check-in counter in detail. She even recalled their names, Faye and Ernie. Pablo said, "Once you had checked in, you ate at the Tranquility Grill next to the motel. So, describe the place." She did so, and in convincing detail. But when he jumped her ahead to the moment at which she left the restaurant, her recollections were phony again, thin and without color. Clearly, her memories had been altered from some point after she had gone into the Tranquility Grill on that Friday evening until she had left the motel and had headed toward Utah the following Tuesday morning. Pablo backtracked, returning Ginger to the small restaurant once more, searching for the exact moment at which the genuine memories ended and the false began. "Tell me about your dinner from the moment you went into Tranquility Grill that Friday evening, minute by minute." Ginger sat up straight in her chair. Her eyes were still closed, but under the shuttered lids they moved visibly, as if she were looking left and right upon entering the Tranquility Grill. She unfisted her hands and got up, much to Pablo's surprise. She walked away from her chair,
toward the center of the room. He walked beside her to prevent her from bumping into furniture. She did not know she was in his apartment, but imagined herself to be making her way between the tables in the restaurant. As she moved, the tension and fear left her, for now she was wholly in that time, prior to all her trouble, when she had had nothing about which to be tense or afraid. In a quiet, anxiety-free voice, she said,
"Took me a while to freshen up and get over here, so it's almost twilight. Outside, the plains are orange in the late sunlight, and the inside of the diner is full of that glow. I think I'll take that booth over in the corner by the window."
Pablo went with her, guiding her past the Picasso painting toward one of the sofas that was decorated with colorful pastel accent pillows. She said,
Smells good. Onions, spices, French fries.
How many people in the diner, Ginger?
She paused and turned her head, surveying the room with closed eyes.
The cook behind the counter and a waitress. Three men. Truck drivers, I guess. On stools at the counter and three at that table. And the chubby priest, another guy over at that booth.
Ginger continued, pointing and counting.
11 in all, plus me.
All right, Pablo said. Let's go to that booth by the window.
She began walking again, smiled vaguely at someone, sidestepped an obstacle that only she could see, then suddenly twitched in surprise, jerked one hand to her face.
Oh!
She stopped.
What is it? Pablo asked. What's happened?
She blinked furiously for a moment, smiled, and spoke to someone in the Tranquility Grill back there on July 6th of last year.
No, I'm all right. It's nothing. I've already brushed it off.
She wiped her face with one hand. See? She had been looking down, as if the other person was seated, and now she raised her eyes as he got up. Pablo waited for her to continue the conversation. She said,
"Well, when you spill salt, you'd better throw some over your shoulder, or God knows what'll happen. My father used to throw it three times, so if you'd been him, you'd have buried me in the stuff."
She started walking again, and Pablo said, "Stop. Wait, Ginger. The man who threw salt over his shoulder. Tell me what he looks like."
"Young,"
she said.
32 or 33, about 5'10", lean, dark hair, dark eyes, sort of handsome, seems shy, sweet.
Dominic Corvaces, no doubt about it. She began to move again. Pablo stayed at her side until, realizing she was about to sit in the restaurant booth, he guided her gently to the sofa. She sat back on it and looked out a window, smiling at her private panorama of Nevada plains washed in the light of a dying sun. Pablo watched and listened while Ginger exchanged pleasantries with the waitress and ordered a bottle of Coors. The beer was served, and Ginger pantomimed sipping it while she watched the sun fade. Seconds ticked past, but Pablo didn't speed her through the scene because he knew they were approaching the crucial moment when her real memories gave way to phony ones. The event, the thing that she saw and should not have seen, had transpired around this time, and Pablo wanted to learn everything he could about the minutes leading up to it. Twilight arrived back there in the past. When the waitress returned, Ginger ordered a bowl of the homemade vegetable soup and a cheeseburger with all the trimmings. Night fell out there in Nevada. Abruptly, before her food had been served, Ginger frowned and said,
"What's that?"
She looked out the imagined window, scowling.
"What do you see?" Pablo asked, chained to his inconvenient vantage point in present-day Boston.
A worried look came over her face, and she stood up.
What the devil is that noise?
She looked toward other people in the restaurant with a puzzled expression, and she spoke to them.
I don't know. I don't know what it is.
She suddenly tottered sideways and nearly fell.
Gewalt!
She reached out as if supporting herself against the side of a booth or table.
Shaking? Why is everything shaking?
She jumped in surprise.
It's knocked over my beer glass. Is it an earthquake? What's happening? What is that sound?
She stumbled again. Now she was frightened.
The door!
She started to run across the living room, though in her mind she was heading toward the exit from the restaurant that, in reality, she had long ago departed.
The door!
She cried again, but then she stopped abruptly, swaying, gasping, shuddering. When Pablo caught up with her, she dropped to her knees and hung her head. What's happening, Ginger?
Nothing.
She had changed in an instant. What's that noise?
What noise?
The robot voice again. Ginger, damn it, what's happening in the Tranquility Grill? Horror was on her face, but she merely said,
I'm having dinner.
That's a false memory.
Having dinner.
He tried to make her continue with the crucial memory of the frightening thing that had been about to happen. But at last he had to accept that the Azrael block, behind which her memories were repressed, took form when she had been running for the restaurant door, and it did not end until the following Tuesday morning, when she drove east toward Salt Lake City. In time, he might be able to chip it down to smaller dimensions, but enough had been accomplished for one day. At last they were making real headway. They knew that on the night of Friday, July 6th, the year before last, Ginger had seen something she had not been meant to see. Having seen it, she had almost certainly been detained in a room at the Tranquility Motel, where someone had used sophisticated brainwashing techniques to conceal the memory of that event from her, and thereby prevent her from carrying word of it to the world. They had worked on her for 3 days, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, releasing her with sanitized recollections on Tuesday. But, in God's name, who were these omnipotent strangers, and what had she seen? Two. Portland, Oregon. Sunday, January 5th, Dominic Corvaces flew to Portland and took a hotel room near the apartment house in which he had once lived. Rain was falling hard, and the air was cold. Except for dinner in the hotel restaurant, he spent the remaining hours of Sunday afternoon and evening at a table by the window of his room, alternately staring out at the rain-lashed city and studying the road maps. Again and again, he mentally reviewed the trip he had taken the summer before last, and would take again, starting tomorrow. As he had told Parker Fane on Christmas, he was convinced that he had stumbled into a dangerous situation out there on the road, and that, paranoid as it sounded, the memory of it had been wiped from his mind. The mail from his unknown correspondent pointed to no other conclusion. 2 days ago, he had received a third envelope without a return address, postmarked New York. Now, when Dom tired of looking at the maps and staring thoughtfully out at the Oregon rain, he picked up that envelope, shook out the contents, and studied them. This time there had been no note, just two Polaroid photographs. The first picture had the least effect on him, although it made him tense, unaccountably tense, considering that it was a photograph of someone who, as far as he knew, was a stranger to him. A young, pudgy priest with unruly auburn hair, freckles, and green eyes. He was facing the camera, sitting in a chair near a small writing desk, a suitcase at his side. He was very erect, head up and shoulders squared off, hands limp in his lap, knees together. The picture disturbed Dom, because the expression on the priest's face was only one step removed
from the lifeless, sightless stare of a corpse. The man was alive, that much was evident from his rigid posture, yet his eyes were chillingly empty. The second photograph hit Dom much harder than the first, and its powerful effect did not diminish with familiarity. A young woman was the subject of this snapshot, and she was no stranger. Although Dom could not recall where they had met, he knew they were acquainted. The sight of her made his heart quicken with a fear similar to that which filled him when he woke from one of his episodes of sleepwalking. She was in her late 20s, blue eyes, silver blonde hair, exquisitely proportioned face. She would have been exceptionally beautiful if her expression had not been precisely that of the priest, slack, dead, empty-eyed. She had been photographed from the waist up, lying in a narrow bed, sheets pulled up chastely to her neck. Restraining straps held her down. One arm was partially bared to allow clearance for an IV needle in her wrist vein. She looked small, helpless, oppressed. The photograph instantly brought to mind his own nightmare, in which unseen men were shouting at him and forcing his face into a sink. A couple of times, that bad dream had not begun at the sink itself, but in a bed in a strange room, where his vision was blurred by a saffron mist. Looking at the young woman, Dom was convinced that somewhere there was a Polaroid shot of him in similar circumstances, strapped to a bed, an IV needle in his arm, his face without expression. When he had shown the two photographs to Parker Fane on Friday, the day they came in the mail, the artist jumped to similar conclusions.
"If I'm wrong, roast me in hell and make sandwiches for the devil, but I swear, this is a snapshot of a woman in a trance or drug-induced stupor undergoing the brainwashing that you evidently underwent. Christ! This situation gets more bizarre and fascinating day by day. It's something you ought to be able to go to the cops about. But you can't, because who's to say which side they'd be on? It may have been a branch of our own government you ran afoul of out there on the road. Anyway, you weren't the only one who got in trouble, good buddy. This priest and this woman also stumbled into it. Whoever went to this much trouble is hiding something damn big, a lot bigger than I thought before."
Now, sitting at the table by his hotel room window, Dom held one picture in each hand, side by side, and let his gaze travel back and forth from the priest to the woman.
"Who are you?" he asked aloud. "What are your names? What happened to us out there?"
Outside, lightning cracked whip-like in the night over Portland, as if a cosmic coachman were urging the rain to fall faster. Like the drumming hooves of 1,000 harried horses, fat, hard-driven raindrops hammered against the wall of the hotel and galloped down the window. Later, Dom fastened himself to the bed with a tether that he had improved considerably since Christmas. First, he wrapped a length of surgical gauze around his right wrist and secured it with adhesive tape, a barrier between rope and flesh to prevent abrasion. He was no longer using an ordinary all-purpose line, but a hawser-laid nylon rope, only a quarter inch in diameter but with a breaking strength of 2,600 pounds. It was expressly made for rock and mountain climbing. He had switched to the sturdier rope because, on the night of December 28th, he had slipped his previous tether by chewing all the way through it while asleep. The mountaineering rope was fray-resistant and nearly as impervious to teeth as copper cable would have been. That night in Portland, he woke three times, wrestling furiously with the tether, perspiring, panting, his racing heart's accelerator floored beneath a heavy weight of fear.
"The moon! The moon!"
3. Las Vegas, Nevada. The day after Christmas, Georgia Monotella took Marcy to Dr. Louis Bezencourt, and the examination turned into an ordeal that frustrated the physician, frightened Georgia, and embarrassed them both.
From the moment Georgia took her into the doctor's waiting room, the girl screamed, screeched, wailed, and wept.
No, doctors! They'll hurt me!
On those rare occasions when Marcy misbehaved, and they were rare indeed, one hard slap on the bottom was usually all that was required to restore her senses and induce contrition. But when Georgia tried that now, it had the opposite effect of what she intended. Marcy screamed louder, wailed more shrilly, and wept more copiously than before. The assistance of an understanding nurse was required to convey the shrieking child from the waiting area into an examination room, by which time Georgia was not only mortified, but worried sick by Marcy's complete irrationality. Dr. Bezencourt's good humor and bedside manner were not enough to quiet the girl, and in fact, she became more frightened and violent the moment he appeared. Marcy pulled away from him when he tried to touch her, screamed, struck him, kicked him until it became necessary for Georgia and a nurse to hold her down. When the doctor used an ophthalmoscope to examine her eyes, her terror reached a crescendo indicated by a sudden loosening of her bladder that was dismayingly reminiscent of a fiasco on Christmas Day. Her uncontrolled urination marked an abrupt change in her demeanor. She became sullen, silent, just as she had for a while on Christmas. She was shockingly pale, and she shivered constantly. She had that eerie detachment that made Georgia think of autism. Lou Bezencourt had no simple diagnosis with which to comfort Georgia. He spoke of neurological and brain disorders and psychological illness. He wanted Marcy to check into Sunrise Hospital for a few days of tests. The ugly scene at Bezencourt's office was just a warm-up for a series of fits Marcy threw at the hospital. The mere sight of doctors and nurses catapulted her into panic, and invariably the panic became outright hysteria that escalated until, exhausted, the child fell into that semi-catatonic trance from which she needed hours to recover. Georgia took a week of sick leave from the casino and virtually lived at Sunrise for 4 days, sleeping on a rollaway bed in Marcy's room. She didn't get much rest. Even in a drugged sleep, Marcy twitched, kicked, whimpered, and cried out in her dreams, "The moon, the moon!" By the fourth night, Sunday, December 29th, worried and weary, Georgia almost needed medical attention for herself. Miraculously, on Monday morning, Marcy's irrational terror simply went away. She still did not like being hospitalized, and she pleaded aggressively to go home, but she no longer appeared to feel that the walls were going to close in and crush her. She remained uneasy in the company of doctors and nurses, but she did not shrink from them in horror or strike them when they touched her. She was still pale, nervous, and watchful, but for the first time in days her appetite was normal, and she ate everything on her breakfast tray. Later in the day, after the final testing had been completed, while Marcy was sitting in bed eating lunch, Dr. Bezencourt spoke with Georgia in the hall. He was a hound-faced man with a bulbous nose and moist, kind eyes.
"Negative, Georgia. Every test, negative. No brain tumors, no cerebral lesions, no neurological dysfunction."
Georgia almost burst into tears.
"Thank God."
"I'm going to refer Marcy to another doctor," Bezencourt said. "Ted Coverley. He's a child psychologist and a good one. I'm sure he'll ferret out the cause of this. Funny thing is, I have a hunch we may have cured Marcy without realizing we were doing it."
Georgia blinked.
"Cured her? What do you mean?"
"In retrospect, I can see that her behavior had all the earmarks of a phobia. Irrational fear, panic attacks. I suspect she had begun to develop a severe phobic aversion to all things medical. And there's a treatment called flooding, wherein the phobic patient is purposefully, even ruthlessly, exposed to the thing he fears for such a long time, hours and hours, that the power of the phobia is shattered, which is what we might have inadvertently done to Marcy when we forced her into the hospital."
"Why would she have developed such a phobia?" Georgia asked. Where would it have come from? She's never had a bad experience with doctors or hospitals. She's never been seriously ill.
Bessencourt shrugged, sidled out of the way of some nurses pushing a patient on a gurney.
We don't know what causes phobias. You don't have to crash in a plane in order to be afraid of flying. Phobias just spring up. Even if we accidentally cured her, there'll be a residual apprehension that Ted Coverley can identify. He'll root out any remaining traces of phobic anxiety. Don't worry, Georgia.
That afternoon, Monday, December 30th, Marcy was released from the hospital. In the car on the way home, she was almost her old self, happily pointing out animal shapes in the clouds. At home, she dashed into the living room and settled down immediately among the piles of new Christmas toys, which she had not yet had much opportunity to enjoy. She still played with the Little Miss Doctor kit, though not exclusively, or with that disturbing intensity that she had exhibited on Christmas Day. Georgia's parents raced over to the apartment. Georgia had kept them away from the hospital by arguing that they might disturb Marcy's delicate condition. Marcy remained in a splendid mood at dinner, sweet and amusing, leaving Georgia's parents disarmed. For the next 3 nights, Marcy slept in Georgia's bed in case she suffered an anxiety attack, but none materialized. The nightmares came with less frequency and less power than before, and Marcy's sleep talk awakened Georgia only twice in 3 nights.
The moon. The moon. The moon.
But now it was a soft and almost forlorn call, rather than a shout. In the morning, at breakfast, she asked Marcy about the dream, but the girl could not remember it.
The moon?
She said, frowning into her bowl of tricks.
Didn't dream about the moon. Dreamed about horses. Can I have a horse someday? Maybe, when we don't live in an apartment anymore.
Marcy giggled.
I know that. You can't keep a horse in an apartment. The neighbors would complain.
Thursday, Marcy saw Dr. Coverley for the first time. She liked him. If she still had an abnormal fear of doctors, she hid it well. That night, Marcy slept in her own bed with only the company of a teddy bear named Murphy. Georgia got up 3 times between midnight and dawn to look in on her daughter. Once, she heard the now familiar chant,
"Moon, moon, moon,"
in a whisper that, because it was an eerie blend of fear and delight, made the hair prickle on her scalp. And on Friday, with 3 days of school vacation still ahead for Marcy, Georgia put her in Kara Persagian's care once more and returned to work. It was almost a relief to get back to the noise and smoke of the casino. Cigarettes, stale beer, and the occasional blast of halitosis were infinitely more pleasing than the antiseptic stink of the hospital. She picked up Marcy at Kara's place, and on the way home the girl excitedly showed her the product of a day spent drawing on butcher's paper. Scores of pictures of the moon, in every imaginable hue. On Sunday morning, January 5th, when Georgia got out of bed and went to brew coffee, she found Marcy at the dining room table, engaged in a curious task. The girl, still in her pajamas, was taking all the photographs out of their picture album and making neat stacks of them.
"I'm putting the pictures in a shoebox because I need the album," the girl said, frowning over the hard word. "I need it for my moon collection."
She held up a picture of the moon clipped from a magazine.
"I'm going to make a big collection."
"Why?"
"Baby, why are you so interested in the moon?" "It's pretty,"
Marcy said. She put the picture on a blank page of the photo album and stared at it. In her fixed gaze, in the intensity of her fascination with the photograph, there was an echo of the single-mindedness with which she had played Little Miss Doctor. With a quiver of apprehension, Georgia thought, "This is how the damn doctor phobia started." quietly, innocently. Has Marcy merely traded one phobia for another? She had the urge to run to the telephone and somehow get hold of Dr. Coverley, even if it was Sunday and his day off. But as she stood by the table, studying her daughter, Georgia decided she was overreacting. Marcy certainly had not traded one phobia for another. After all, the girl wasn't afraid of the moon, just, well, strangely fascinated by it. A temporary enthusiasm. Any parent of a bright 7-year-old was accustomed to these short-lived but fiercely burning fascinations and infatuations. Nevertheless, Georgia decided she would tell Dr. Coverley about it when she took Marcy to his office for a second session on Tuesday. At 12:20 a.m., Monday, before she turned in for the night, Georgia looked in on Marcy to see if she was sleeping soundly. The girl was not in bed. In her dark room, she had drawn a chair up to the window and was sitting there staring out.
"Honey, what's wrong?" "Nothing's wrong. Come see,"
Marcy said softly, dreamily. Heading toward the girl, Georgia said, "What is it, Peanut?"
"The moon,"
Marcy said, her eyes fixed on the silvery crescent high in the black vault of the sky.
"The moon."
Four. Boston, Massachusetts. On Monday, January 6th, the wind from the Atlantic was bitterly cold and unrelenting, and all of Boston was humbled by it. On the blustery streets, heavily bundled and bescarfed people hurried toward sanctuary with their shoulders drawn up and heads tucked down. In the hard, gray winter light, the modern glass office towers appeared to be constructed of ice, while the older buildings of historic Boston huddled together, presenting a drab and miserable face, utterly unlike their charm and stateliness in better weather. Last night, sleet had fallen. The barren trees were jacketed in glittering ice, bare black branches poking through the white crust like the marrow core revealed beneath the outer layers of shattered bones. Herbert, the efficient major domo who kept the Hannaby household functioning smoothly, drove Ginger Weiss to her 7th post-Christmas meeting with Pablo Jackson. The wind and the previous night's ice storm had brought down power lines and disrupted the traffic lights at more than half the intersections. They finally reached Newbury Street at 11:05 a.m., just 5 minutes past Ginger's 11 o'clock appointment. After the breakthrough during Saturday's session, Ginger had wanted to contact the people at the Tranquility Motel in Nevada and broach the subject of the unremembered event that had transpired there on the night of July 6th, the summer before last. Either the owners of that motel were accomplices of those who had tampered with Ginger's memory, or they were victims like her. If they had been subjected to brainwashing, perhaps they also were experiencing anxiety attacks of one sort or another. Pablo was firmly opposed to immediate confrontation. He felt the risks were too great. If the owners of the motel were not victims but associates of the victimizers, Ginger might be putting herself in grave danger. "You've got to be patient. Before approaching them, you must have as much information as you can possibly obtain." She had suggested they go to the police, seeking protection and an investigation. But Pablo had convinced her that the police would not be interested. She had no proof that she had been the victim of a mental mugging. Besides, the local constabulary could not unravel a crime across state lines. She'd have to go to the federal authorities or local Nevada police, and in either case she might be unwittingly seeking help from the very people responsible for what had been done to her. Frustrated, but unable to find a hole in Pablo's arguments, Ginger had agreed to continue following his program of treatment. He had wanted Sunday to himself so he could review the crucial tape of Saturday's session, and he had said he was not available Monday morning because he intended to see a friend in the hospital.
"But you come back at, say, 1 o'clock Monday afternoon,
and we'll begin chipping away at the edges of that memory block. En pantoufle, in slippers, as they say, in a relaxed manner. This morning he had called her from the hospital to say that his friend was being discharged sooner than expected, and that he, Pablo, would be home by 11 o'clock if she would like to come earlier than planned.
You can help me make lunch.
Now, disembarking from the elevator and stepping quickly along the short hall to Pablo's apartment, Ginger decided that she would make every effort to control her natural impatience and to settle for making progress en pantoufle, as the magician was determined they would. The front door was ajar. Assuming he had left it open for her, she stepped into the foyer. Closing the door, she said,
"Pablo?"
In another room, someone grunted. Something clattered softly, something thudded to the floor.
"Pablo?"
He did not answer. Moving into the living room, she called out louder than before,
"Pablo?"
Silence. One of the library's double doors was open, and a light was on. Ginger entered and saw Pablo lying face down on the floor near the Sheraton desk. He had evidently just returned from his visit to his hospitalized friend, for he was still wearing galoshes and an overcoat. As she rushed to him and knelt at his side, grim possibilities occurred to her. Cerebral hemorrhage, thrombosis or embolism, massive heart attack. But she was not prepared for what she found when she eased him onto his back. Pablo had been shot, high in the chest, and bright red arterial blood welled from the bullet hole. His eyes fluttered open, and although they looked unfocused, he seemed to know who she was. Blood bubbled over his lower lip. He got out a single word in an urgent whisper.
"Run!"
Her instinctive reaction upon seeing him prone before the desk had been that of a friend and physician. Anguished, she had gone immediately to his aid. But until Pablo said, "Run," Ginger did not understand that her own life might be in jeopardy. Suddenly she realized that she had heard no gunfire, which meant a silencer-equipped pistol. The assailant was no ordinary burglar, someone infinitely more dangerous. All those considerations flashed through her mind in an instant. Her heart pounding, she rose and turned toward the door. The gunman, tall and broad-shouldered, wearing a leather top coat belted tightly at the waist, came out from behind the door, holding the silencer-equipped pistol. He was big, but surprisingly less threatening in appearance than she had expected. He was her age, clean-cut, with innocent blue eyes, and a face unsuited for menace. When he spoke, the disparity between his unremarkable appearance and his murderous actions was even greater, for his first words were a tremulous apology of sorts. "Shouldn't have happened. Didn't have to happen, for Christ's sake. I was duping those tapes on a high-speed recorder. That's all I wanted. Dupes of the tapes." He was pointing to the desk, and for the first time Ginger noticed an open attaché case in which was nestled a compact piece of electronic equipment. Tape cassettes were scattered across the top of the desk, and she knew at once what tapes they were.
"Let's call an ambulance," she said.
She edged toward the phone, but he stopped her by gesturing pointedly and angrily with the gun.
"High-speed duplication," he said,
torn between rage and tears.
"I could have made copies of all 6 of your sessions and been out of here. He wasn't supposed to be home for another fucking hour, at least."
Ginger grabbed a chair cushion and used it to prop up Pablo's head so he would not choke on the blood and phlegm in his throat. Obviously stunned by what had happened, the gunman said,
"He just comes in, so quiet. Gliding in here like a goddamn ghost."
Ginger remembered how gracefully and elegantly the magician carried himself, as if each movement was prelude to an act of prestidigitation. Pablo coughed, closed his eyes. Ginger wanted to do more for him, but the only remedy was heroic surgery. At the moment,
She could only keep a hand on his shoulder in a feeble attempt to reassure him. She looked up entreatingly, but the gunman only said,
"And what the hell's he doing? Packing a gun? A fucking 80-year-old man. A gun in his fist, as if he knows how to handle something like this."
Until now, Ginger had not noticed the pistol on the carpet, a few feet from Pablo's outflung hand. When she saw it, a cripplingly sharp pang of horror went through her, and she nearly passed out. For in that instant she knew Pablo had been aware all along that it was dangerous to help her. She had not suspected that the mere attempt to probe at the memory block would quickly draw the unwanted attentions of men like this one in the leather topcoat. Because this meant she was being watched. Maybe not hour by hour, or even every day, but they were keeping tabs on her. The moment she first called Pablo, she unwittingly endangered his life. And somehow, he had known. For he had been packing a gun. Now, Ginger felt the weight of guilt.
"If he hadn't pulled that stupid 22," the gunman said miserably, "and if he hadn't insisted on calling the cops, I'd have walked away without laying a hand on him. I didn't want to hurt him. Shit." "For God's sake," Ginger said beseechingly, "let me call an ambulance. If you didn't mean to hurt him, then let's get help."
The gunman shook his head, and his gaze moved to the crumpled magician.
"Too late, anyway. He's dead."
Those last two words, like a pair of hard punches, knocked the breath out of her and drew the shadowy curtain of unconsciousness to the edges of her vision. One glance at the old man's glassy eyes was enough to confirm what the gunman had said, yet she resisted the truth. She lifted his left hand and put her fingertips to his thin black wrist, feeling for a pulse. Finding none, she searched along the carotid artery in his throat, but in spite of the remaining warmth of the flesh, there was only an awful stillness where once had been the throb of life.
"No," she said. "Oh, no."
She touched Pablo's dark brow, not with the diagnostic intent of a physician, but tenderly, lovingly. Her heart was so painfully constricted with grief that it was difficult to believe she had known the magician only 2 weeks. Like her father, she was quick to give her heart, and because Pablo was the man he was, the gift of affection and love was even more easily bestowed than usual.
"I'm sorry," the killer said shakily. "I'm really sorry. If he hadn't tried to stop me, I'd have walked right out of here. Now, I've killed someone, haven't I? And you've seen my face."
Blinking back her tears, suddenly aware that she could not afford to grieve right now, Ginger rose slowly to her feet and faced him. As if thinking aloud, the gunman said,
"You've got to be dealt with now, too. I'll have to ransack the place,
empty out drawers, take a few things of value and make it look like you two walked in on a burglar." He chewed worriedly on his lower lip.
"Yeah, it'll work.
Instead of copying the tapes, I'll just take them so they won't be here to raise suspicions." He looked at Ginger and winced.
"I'm sorry. Jesus, I really am. But that's the way it'll have to be. I wish it didn't. It's partly my fault. Should have heard the old bastard coming in. Shouldn't have let him surprise me."
He moved toward her.
"Should I maybe rape you, too? I mean, would a burglar just shoot a good-looking girl like you? Wouldn't he rape you first? Wouldn't that make this look more real?"
He came closer, and she began to back away.
"God, I don't know if I can do it. I mean, how can I get a hard-on and do it to you when I know I've got to kill you afterward?"
He kept coming toward her, and she backed up against the bookshelves.
"I don't like this. Believe me, I don't. This shouldn't have to happen. I really hate this."
His apparently genuine pity, repeated apologies, and sorrowful self-recriminations gave Ginger the creeps. He would have been less frightening if he had been pitiless and bloodthirsty. The fact that he had scruples, but could set them aside long enough to commit one rape and two murders, that made him more of a monster. He stopped 6 feet from her and said,
"Please take off your coat."
It was useless to beg, but she hoped to make him overconfident.
"I won't give a good description of you. I swear. Please let me go."
"Wish I could." His face defined remorse.
"Take off your coat."
Buying time while she arrived at a course of action, Ginger slowly unbuttoned the coat. Her hands were shaking, but she exaggerated those genuine tremors and fumbled with the buttons. At last she shrugged out of the coat and let it drop to the floor. He stepped closer. The pistol was only inches from her chest. He was more relaxed, holding the gun less rigidly than before, thrusting it forward less aggressively, though he was by no means lax with it.
"Please, don't hurt me."
She continued to beg because, if he thought she was nearly paralyzed with abject fear, he might slip up and give her an opportunity for escape.
"I don't want to hurt you," he said,
as if deeply offended by the implication that he had any choice in the matter.
"Didn't want to hurt him, either. That old fool was responsible for this, not me. Listen, I'll make it as painless as I can, I promise you that."
Still holding the gun in his right hand, he used his left hand to touch her breasts through her sweater. She endured his fondling because he might become careless as he grew aroused. In spite of his claims that his empathy would render him impotent, Ginger was certain he'd have no difficulty raping her. Beneath his regret and sympathy, beneath the sensitivity he wished to project more for his own benefit than for hers, he was taking an unconscious, savage pleasure in what he had done and would do. In spite of his gentle voice, violence burned in every word he spoke. He stank of violence. He said,
"Very pretty. Petite, yet so nicely built."
He slipped his hand under her sweater, gripped her bra, gave it a hard yank that broke it. As elastic snapped, the bra straps dug painfully into her shoulders, the metal clasp at her back bit the skin. He grimaced as if her pain was transmitted to him.
"I'm sorry. Did I hurt you? I didn't mean it. I'll be more careful."
He pushed aside the ruined brassiere and put his cool, clammy hand on her bare breasts. Filled equally with terror and revulsion, Ginger pressed back even harder against the bookshelves, which jabbed painfully into her back. The gunman was less than an arm's length away from her now, but he kept the pistol between them. The muzzle was pressed coldly against her bare midriff, leaving her no room to maneuver. If she tried to twist free of him, she would be gut-shot for her temerity. Fondling her, he continued to speak softly and to express great sadness at the necessity of raping and killing her, as though she simply must understand, as though it would be unthinkably cruel of her not to bestow upon him full absolution for the sin of taking her life. With nowhere to run, with his monotonous self-justifications washing over her in numbing waves of words, subjected to his groping hand, Ginger was gripped by a claustrophobia so intense she felt the urge to claw at him and force him to pull the trigger just to end it. His certs-scented breath had a cloying, minty aroma that, by its pervasiveness, gave her the feeling she was closed up in a bell jar with him. She whimpered, pleaded with wordless sounds, turned her head from side to side as if trying to deny the reality of the assault. The picture of demoralization and terror that she presented could not have been more convincing if she had had days to practice, but there was unfortunately little calculation in it. Further inflamed by her distress, he pawed at her more roughly than before.
"I think I can do it, baby. I think I can do it to you.
Feel me, baby. Just feel me. He pressed his body to hers and ground his pelvis against her. Incredibly, he seemed to think that, under such stressful and tragic circumstances, his rampant tumescence was a tribute to her erotic appeal, and that somehow she ought to be flattered. Her reaction could only have been a disappointment for him. When he pressed and rubbed himself against her, he was obliged to stop jamming the gun into her belly. Swept away by his own excitement, convinced that Ginger was weak and helpless, he did not even keep the weapon pointed at her, but held it to one side with the muzzle aimed at the floor. Ginger's terror was exceeded by her loathing and anger, and the moment the pistol swung away from her, she translated those pent-up emotions into action. Turning her head to the side, she slumped against him as if about to faint in fear or in a swoon of reluctant passion, an action that brought her mouth to his throat. In swift succession, she bit him hard in the Adam's apple, slammed one knee into his crotch, and clawed at his gun hand to keep the pistol away from her. He partially blocked the knee, limiting the damage to his privates, but he was unprepared for the bite. Shocked, horrified, and reeling from the devastating pain in his throat, the gunman pushed away from her and stumbled backward two steps. She had bitten deep, and now she gagged on the taste of his blood, though she did not permit her revulsion to delay her counterattack. She grabbed his gun hand, brought it to her mouth, and bit his wrist. A sharp cry of pain and astonishment burst from him. Because she was delicate, waif-like, he had not taken her seriously. As she bit him again, he dropped the gun, but simultaneously he made a fist of his other hand and with tremendous force slammed it into her back. She was driven to her knees and thought for a moment that he had broken her spine. Pain, as bright and scintillant as an electric current, shot up her back into her neck, flashed through her skull. Stunned, her vision briefly blurred, Ginger almost did not see him bending to retrieve the gun. Just as his fingers touched the butt, she frantically threw herself at his legs. Seeing her coming and hoping to jump out of her reach, he whipped upright as if he were a lashed-down sapling suddenly cut loose. When she hit him a fraction of a second later, he windmilled his arms in a brief attempt to keep his balance. Falling backward, he crashed into one of the library's chairs, knocked over a small table and a lamp, and rolled onto Pablo Jackson's corpse. Equally breathless, staring warily at each other, they were both petrified for a moment. They were on their sides on the floor, curled fetally in reaction to their pains, gasping for breath. To Ginger, the gunman's eyes seemed as wide and round as clock faces, proof that he was filled with fevered thoughts of his own mortality ticking close. The bite would not kill him. She had not bitten through the jugular vein or the carotid artery, had merely pierced the thyroid cartilage, mangling tissue, severing a few small vessels. However, it was easy to understand why he might be convinced it was a mortal wound. The pain must be excruciating. He put his unbitten hand